I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, tearing up forests and farmland to put up a strip mall. How much is development contributing to the rising water in the Midwest? But first, an update on that flooding. The Federal Emergency Management Agency said today that more than 11 million people across the Midwest have been affected by the flooding and extreme weather this spring. Iowa residents are mopping up after extensive flooding, but the water is rushing downstream to Illinois and Missouri. John Watson in Foley, Missouri, is camping on his roof, watching the water creep up to his home. He says he's ready for it, and he's got two guns with him.
It's not loaded or nothing. I have a 22 for varmints that's going to come up here, rats when they start swimming up. And then I got a bigger gun for looters.
The Army Corps of Engineers reported that at least 23 levees along the Mississippi failed this week. The river overflowed almost every levee in Lincoln County, Missouri, just upstream from St. Louis, even before the expected crest. We have Andrew Binder from Lincoln County's Emergency Command Center on the line. Andy, thanks for joining us. And would you tell us what's happening in your county today?
Yes. Right now, we have 4 confirmed breaches in our levee systems. From Winfield East up to Ellsbury, that's dumping in quite a bit of water. Right now, east of Highway 79, which is the eastern portion of Lincoln County, is approximately 70% underwater. We have about 350 homes that are affected from the flooding right now, and according to the Army Corps of Engineers, we have another foot or so of water expected to arrive through Tuesday.
Well, we know that these levees were mostly protecting farmland, but you say there are about 350 homes affected as well. How many people, and how bad will be the damage to people?
Well, the damage to people, the majority of the folks east of Highway 79 are evacuated. They have left their homes. And, you know, I can probably say that not one person's been injured or hurt in any of our operations here in eastern Lincoln County. However, our secondary levees, which we have built using the Army Corps of Engineers and the Army National Guard, have pushed back the Mississippi River away from many of our townships. We can say proudly that we are the only county that has successfully bolstered and fortified a levee to push the Mississippi River away from our town.
Well, any idea when people might be able to return to their homes?
Well, going back to 1993, it took months before the water subsided and people could go back to their homes. So it's going to be months before they can get back in their homes.
Well, very sad situation. Keep up the good work. Andrew Binder from Lincoln County's Emergency Command Center, one of the county's worst hit by the rising waters in Missouri. Also with us is Adam Allington. He's a reporter for KWMU in St. Louis. Now, Adam, you've been traveling to a lot of communities along the Mississippi River north of St. Louis, and tell us what you've been seeing.
Well, I have been traveling up there for the past several days, and what I've been seeing is the water gradually rising, overtopping levees, and then pushing rather quickly towards some of these communities. On the far north side of where I went, the town of Clarksville, Missouri, actually doesn't have a levee protecting their town. So what they've done is they've built a massive sandbag wall out of millions, millions literally, of sandbags to protect their town. And they've been successful at holding back the river. Other communities farther downstream haven't had as much success, particularly where levee breaches occurred. That water just rushed toward the communities very quickly, and like Mr. Binder said, they've had to shore up the secondary levees to try to form small islands around the densest portion of the town to keep the water sort of just pushed away until it flows farther downstream. It is worth noting that these levees along eastern Lincoln County are predominantly agricultural levees. That means they're built to protect farm fields. So as tragic as it is for a lot of the people in these areas, it's nowhere near as devastating as what we've seen farther north up in Iowa.
Well, what does it mean, though, to the farmers? I mean, this is the nation's top producers of grain, corn, soy, wheat. What does it mean for the farmers there?
Oh, it's completely devastating. That as we follow the story forward, that may end up being one of the true the most devastating outcomes from this flood. I was down there yesterday speaking with a sod farmer as his crew was hastily scooping up sod, harvesting sod, as the water was literally rushing right up to the wheels
Wow.
of their tractor.
Trying to salvage anything.
Right, trying to get that sod up and out. Corn farmers, soybean farmers, in a year when they could have commanded record prices for their crop, they'll likely take a complete loss. And this is some of the best farmland in Missouri, so it's obviously a very devastating situation for farmers in that area.
And we're also reading that many people are saying they're thinking of not going back to their homes. Have you heard that sentiment?
Yeah. I mean, you get a little bit of everything. People live in this area because they like it, and people like the connection to the river. But a lot of people in these communities remember all too well the Great Flood of 93, which was called a 500-year flood event. What we're seeing now will likely also be a 500-year flood event. So we've seen two of these massive floods in 15 years, and many residents are starting to wonder now if it's worth it to live so close to a floodplain.
Adam Allington is a reporter for KWMU in St. Louis. Adam, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Glad to talk to you.
We turn now to Bob Criss, professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. And Bob, meteorologists say the flooding started with an unusual weather event. 15 inches of rain fell in parts of Iowa over the past month. But in your opinion, is this flooding just a weather event? The Midwest has now seen two 500-year floods in 15 years.
Yes, well, we are certainly making flooding worse, and there's several components. One is the constriction of the river, both by increasingly higher levees and walling off the floodplain for development. And the more we do this, if the river can't spread out, it simply has to go up. And so for a given meteorological condition, whether it's 15 inches of rain or whatever it is, the river rises to a higher level now than it has historically. It certainly can be established very clearly at St. Louis, where we have very long-term records.
Back to Robert E. Lee, who I understand mapped the Mississippi River in St. Louis Harbor at 4,000 feet wide. How wide is it today?
It's only 1,500 feet wide, and that's part of the point. The entire lower Missouri River has been affected the same way. It's only about half as wide as it was when Lewis and Clark floated up the river.
So that's one of the reasons that flooding has gotten worse over the years, a human responsibility, really. What are some of the other reasons that flooding's worse today?
There is the possibility of climate change, and I actually prefer to view that not in long-term increases in rainfall. Those may exist. I believe they're modest. It may be that we have a higher frequency of severe storms, like the 15 inches you just mentioned. And the other component lots of folks like to point out is as we develop land everywhere, whatever we do, we tend to decrease the permeability of the soil and increase the rapidity of the runoff.
You mean when we build roads and houses on floodplains?
Well, yes, and when we knock down a forest on a hillside to put up a subdivision. Historically, our land was forest and prairie in this part of the world. And during heavy rainfalls, the creeks and the rivers would hardly respond. And I've looked at creeks and parks that even after heavy rainstorms, they hardly flow any faster than they do under normal conditions. It's a very gentle response. And yet you look at an urban stream, some of our concrete channels, those things flash flood.
So some human reengineering of the landscape has changed that. I've also read that the federal government bought low-lying land after the 1993 flood to prevent development there, but many homeowners rebuilt their existing homes and some communities raised their levees, as you were just talking about. How much development has there been in your area, and has anyone raised concerns about it?
Many concerns have been raised, and I believe that St. Louis has got the worst record of post-1993 floodplain development anywhere in the world. We have many, many miles, square miles, of new commercial development, industrial parks, strip malls, in areas that were inundated in 1993. And there's several areas where this has been done. The government has put in huge levies at public cost to develop these floodplains and to convert what was farmland just a few years ago into these commercial developments. It's been a big windfall for some folks, and the rest of us are going to be holding the bag. This is a matter of privatizing the profit and socializing the loss.
Well, USA Today reports, too, that at least half of the 31 levees that have already been breached were not built to withstand a 100-year flood. And that's an event so bad that it only has a 1% chance of happening in a year. Yet that's the standard level of protection, and federal flood insurance is not required in areas with that protection. Do you think, given what you've seen in St. Louis, that that standard needs to change?
Well, the first thing I would like to see changed is this language that these events are 100-year floods or 500-year floods or 500-year levees or 100-year levees. Those kind of words lead people to underestimate the risk and to overestimate their level of protection. It is not statistically likely at all that we have had so many 100-year or 200-year or 500-year floods as we've had in the last 15 years. The rivers are flooding worse every year in response to all these land use changes and changes to the river. And so you can't compare a 38-foot flood today with a 38-foot flood 100 years ago.
So
100 years ago, that was a very rare event. Today, it happens all the time.
So we need to rethink a lot, it sounds like. Do you think there's a comprehensive river management plan that could take everyone's needs into account? Is it possible to do this?
It is very difficult to do this because there are so many so-called stakeholders, so many people with disparate points of view. But we do need to establish a sensible language to discuss the phenomenon of flooding.
So less development, less building on floodplains, what needs to change?
Well, again, first let's change our language so that we have more appropriate words to describe the frequency of flooding and flood risk. Those calculations really need to be reexamined. Second of all, we need to cease conducting activities that are exacerbating the flooding problem in the Midwest, and that is building a new strip mall and floodplain is a bad idea. And it was obviously a bad idea in 1993. It was obviously a bad idea long before that. It's a misuse of the land, converting the best cropland in the world, in a starving world, to commercial real estate. Is not only geologically and economically stupid, it's an environmental and humanitarian disaster. And there is no reason we need to continue doing things that are so incredibly thoughtless. If we would just stop magnifying the problem and recognizing it for what it is and using correct words to describe the problem, I think we'd be making a lot of progress immediately.
Bob, it sounds like a lot needs to change. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks very much.
Bob Criss is professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Just ahead, summer begins today. Will the bees be buzzing? Back in a minute, here and now. The sound of summer wouldn't be complete without a little of this. Bees may be an annoying pest at your picnic, but they are vital to our agricultural system, and they're disappearing. Scientists can't understand why or how to stop it. The mysterious decline in honeybee populations over the past few years has begun to worry food retailers. Recently, Whole Foods stores throughout the Northeast have begun giving customers the chance to donate to bee research, and Häagen-Dazs has donated $150 million to Penn State's honeybee-related programs. What's all the buzz about? With us to discuss the disappearance of bees is Professor John Barrand at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. John, why are bees dying?
That's a good question. In recent years, since 2006, some beekeepers have been experiencing large numbers of die-off of bees, up to as much as 50 to 90% of their bee colonies dying. And this particular syndrome that was noticed with this large loss of bees was somewhat unusual from what beekeepers had noticed with their usual die-off that they see. There were no dead bees surrounding the hives. The hives were abandoned of bees. There was only a few workers left in the hives.
So the bees just flew off and didn't come back?
That's what they thought. that's what appears to happen, is the bees have just abandoned the hive. That's what's referred to as colony collapse disorder. And it was an unusual phenomenon that had really not been reported before. Usually, beekeepers are used to experiencing some die-off in bees. Maybe they may lose about 10 to 15% of their bees every year. And when that was the case, it was often easy to diagnose the problem. There are a lot of bacterial pathogens, other viral pathogens, as well as fungal pathogens. And with a colony collapse disorder, there were only a few bees left in the hive. And so the difficulty became finding those bees that were missing, that had disappeared.
So who were you working with to try and understand colony collapse disorder?
At the University of Massachusetts, we've recently formed the UMass Bee Consortium. We're interested not only in problems with honeybees, but we're also interested in problems that are occurring in bumblebees.
But you're working with the beekeepers to try to learn what could be causing these massive die-offs.
Yes. There's actually two sort of classes of beekeepers. Those local beekeepers, some of their hives are used for pollination of local crops. But there's a whole other group of beekeepers who are sort of what we refer to as commercial beekeepers or migratory beekeepers. And it's these migratory beekeepers that are experiencing these major problems with colony collapse disorder. We don't have so much of a problem with colony collapse disorder with local beekeepers.
Why? Why is it that if you have a few hives in your backyard, it doesn't seem to happen? But if you're somebody who trucks bees around the country, you could experience a huge die-off.
These bees may be used for pollination on almonds 1 week. They may be in New York pollinating apples the next week. They may be in Maine on blueberries after that, and then in Massachusetts pollinating cranberries. It may be a problem where those bees are more stressed. They're more susceptible to disease. So these are the kinds of things that we're interested in.
Well, I mentioned the corporate support for honeybee research with Whole Foods and Häagen-Dazs. Häagen-Dazs even created a flavor called Vanilla Honeybee, and it's giving a portion of proceeds from sales to research. And you've also just received a grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So clearly, this bee research is becoming a more important issue. Do you think what's needed is more money to solve this problem?
I think the problem with colony collapse disorder has really drawn attention to how important bees are to agriculture and to our economy. The situation with bees with colony collapse disorder is a complex situation. Scientists have not been able to identify a single cause for colony collapse disorder. And it's going to take the efforts of groups of scientists working together, people who are experts on bee behavior, people who are experts in bee practices, bee culture, people who are interested in pathogens of bees, all working together to try to solve this problem. This is a difficult problem to solve, and it's going to take the efforts of lots of different people working on it to try to reach and the answer to the solution to this problem.
If the current trend continues, will there be enough bees to pollinate crops? And are any crops threatened now? I know the cranberry and blueberry growers in Massachusetts seem worried.
Growers who rely on bees to pollinate their crops, the cranberry growers, the blueberry growers, they're concerned about, are there going to be enough bees available for them to pollinate their crops? In the short term, it looks like that there's not really going to be a serious problem. There's a limit on the number. They might not be able to get the numbers of bees that they need. So we're concerned about that, and we're also interested in native pollinators. What other types of pollinators, what other types of bees, particularly honeybees, are going to be around to sort of fill that gap? And so we're also interested in what's the health of bumblebees within the state of Massachusetts, and will there be enough bumblebees around to sort of pick up the slack in case a situation arises where there's not enough honeybees to carry out pollination?
Well, good luck with your research. John Barand at the University of Massachusetts Amherst is part of the UMass Amherst Bee Consortium studying the decline in honeybees. Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
Next week on Here and Now, he's filed impeachment charges against Vice President Dick Cheney. Now Congressman Dennis Kucinich has filed them against President George Bush. With so many voters unhappy with President Bush, why isn't impeachment taken more seriously? Also, the next First Ladies of the United States. We take a closer look at Michelle Obama and Cindy McCain. How are they handling the campaign? And what type of partners are they likely to be in the White House? That's next week. Still ahead today, the runoff presidential election in Zimbabwe. Are Africa's leaders doing enough? Here and Now. Zimbabwe's presidential runoff elections are set for a week from today, but a spokesman for opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai announced today that the leader of the Movement for Democratic Change Party, or MDC, may pull out of the race against incumbent Robert Mugabe. The first round of voting was held in March, and though the MDC received more votes than the ruling ZANU-PF party, it did not reach the greater than 50% majority required to avoid a runoff. Since then, at least 60 political murders have been recorded. Independent human rights activists have implicated Mugabe's party in the attacks, and Mugabe himself has threatened to go to war if he does not emerge victorious. Andrew Meldrum is a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University this year. He covered Zimbabwe for The Economist and The Guardian for more than 20 years, from 1980 to 2003, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Hi.
So Tsvangirai might pull out of this election. Why would he do that?
Because the level of violence has reached levels that neither he nor anyone else really expected it to. And although Robert Mugabe claims that it's the opposition party that's carrying out the violence, it's very, very clear to everybody who is in Zimbabwe and outside that the violence is actually state-sponsored. For instance, just 2 days ago, the wife of the mayor of Harare, who is an opposition, he's an MDC member, the wife was taken from her home and beaten to death in front of their four-year-old son. Two other wives of MDC officials who are in hiding, the wives were taken from their homes and they were beaten to death as well. Four MDC youth officials were burnt to death in a home. I could go on and on. It's more than 60 dead now. They say that Amnesty International says the death toll is 70 and rising every day. So this death toll has really become a really horrific thing. The violence is across the country, and I think that Morgan Tsvangirai just couldn't foresee that this would be anything approaching a free and fair election.
Well, even U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who's in the region, said yesterday that there's no chance the upcoming runoff elections could possibly be free and fair. So if he pulls out, should the election even take place?
Well, this is the problem. Is that if Tsvangirai pulls out, then it's as much as giving Robert Mugabe an unopposed election victory. But I think what has happened in the past week is that African countries, and certainly the United States and others, have said the level of violence that we all see is just so terrible that really it, not only can we not have free and fair elections, we don't think elections should take place in this climate of violence at all. And so Tsvangirai is, I think he has confidence from other African leaders, that if he does not partake in the election, that no one is going to endorse Robert Mugabe as legitimately elected. And that's the thing, is that really what is needed is African support for an effort to make the climate suitable for free and fair elections in Zimbabwe.
So are African leaders stepping up to help in this situation, help resolve it?
I think that they are going to be forced with a situation where they must do so. And already several African leaders, particularly from Tanzania, the president of Tanzania and the foreign minister of Tanzania, the prime minister of Kenya, Raila Odinga, has spoken out forthrightly, and from Botswana. So we're seeing a coalition build. The major player who is not a part of it, however, is South Africa's President Thabo Mbeki. But he did go to Zimbabwe 2 days ago on an unscheduled emergency visit to speak to Robert Mugabe, saying, look, I've backed you all the way up to now, but, you know, this is getting to a point where I just cannot back you. And please tone down the violence. And that was on Thabo Mbeki's 66th birthday, so you know it was an urgent meeting.
And didn't he also meet with Tsvangirai, which upset Mugabe?
He also met with Tsvangirai, and that upset Mugabe. But, you know, I think that Thabo Mbeki said, too bad, he's a player. We have to, you know, engage all players.
Well, why has it taken so long for African leaders to really get involved here and try to, you know, urge Zimbabwe to take some action and change what's happening? Because this has been going on for a while now.
Zimbabwe's slide into ruin and violence and terror has been going on since the year 2000. It's been going on for 8 years. And the problem is that African leaders have respect for Robert Mugabe for the vital role that he played back in the 1970s, which was fighting a bloody, bitter fight to end white minority Rhodesian rule. And they all recognize, particularly in South Africa, that the Robert Mugabe's victory against white minority rule Rhodesia was key to helping to undermine apartheid in South Africa.
Could there be any chance to convince Mugabe and Tsvangirai to come together and form some sort of coalition government, as happened in Kenya when there was a very contested, close election there?
It's conceivable, but not very likely, and I'm not sure that that would be the proper solution. Robert Mugabe now really has blood dripping from his hands. As I say, the American ambassador has witnessed it. The Tanzanian observer mission saw two people shot dead by state agents in front of them. These are electoral observers. So Robert Mugabe really has been, at the helm of a government that is unleashing state terror and violence, torture and murder on its own people. And should he be rewarded for that by being the head of a coalition government? That's a question. Robert Mugabe doesn't even cooperate with members of his own party. It's very unlikely that he would be able to cooperate with an opposition party that he is accused of treason and has tried to get them to the margins of society. And I don't think Robert Mugabe would cooperate. What I think is the solution is a transitional government that might have both members of both parties in it that would lead to free and fair elections that would be fully monitored by African peacekeeping forces. And I say peacekeeping forces because for free and fair and this level of violence in Zimbabwe, you have to have people who are monitoring, saying you cannot go in and beat people and you cannot torture and kill people.
That was Andy Meldrum talking to us from Harvard University. He reported from Zimbabwe for both The Economist and The Guardian newspaper. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thanks, Monica.
And on another note, on a day where a thick haze of pollution limited visibility to half a mile, officials in Beijing, China, announced their long-awaited plan to limit traffic ahead of the August Olympics. Half of Beijing's more than 3 million vehicles will be taken off the roads from July 20th until September 20th. Vehicles will be allowed on alternate days based on even or odd registration numbers. Up to three-quarters of government cars and trucks will stay off Beijing streets, and vehicles from outside the city will largely be banned from entering. International Olympic Committee President Jacques Roga has said outdoor endurance events lasting more than 1 hour will be postponed if air quality is poor. Visibility in Beijing was less than half a mile yesterday, even though the Beijing Environmental Protection Bureau website described the conditions as only slightly polluted. Officials have denied that the machines taking air quality readings have been moved away from polluted areas. And just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, here-now.org. And you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, they're still sweeping the streets here in Boston after yesterday's parade for the NBA champion Boston Celtics, who dispensed of Kobe Bryant and the LA Lakers in historic fashion Tuesday to win Boston's first title in 22 years. Joining us to talk all things sports is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Monica.
So, Bill, the Neo Trio, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, and Ray Allen, they're all back next year. I mean, does this mean the start of another Celtics dynasty?
Let's not say Neo Trio too much. Only game producer Gary Wallach came up with that, and I don't want to encourage him. He'll
it's
do
good,
this
though.
Sort of thing all the time. I'd be a little careful about calling the Celtics a dynasty at this point. They were thoroughly impressive in winning the championship. However, the veterans whom they acquired in order to put this team together are all on the far side of their career, maybe 3-4 good years left for some of these fellas. And also, you don't really want to talk about a dynasty in the context of the Boston Celtics unless a team has won, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 championships in a row, which is, of course, what the old Celtics used to do regularly.
So we're getting ahead of ourselves.
I think so, a little bit. Let's just enjoy the moment.
Okay. Well, I certainly enjoyed watching golf, and I'm not usually a golf watcher, and I don't play golf. But after winning the U.S. Open in a playoff Monday against Rocco Mediate, Tiger Woods, he shocked the golf world with the news that he needs reconstructive surgery for his left knee, and he's going to sit out the rest of the season. So it turns out to win the Open, it turns out that Woods played 91 holes with a double stress fracture in his left tibia.
Mm-hmm.
How did he do it, and what now for the PGA?
Well, I guess the answer to the first question, how did he do it, is he did it because he's Tiger Woods. And it was a demonstration, I think, of the extent to which Tiger Woods has really lapped the field in professional golf. He is so much better than most of these other guys on any given day that even with the handicaps of injuries and pain, he was able to win again.
So what happens in the PGA, then,
well,
with him out?
They're going to be scraping cobwebs off, locker rooms all over the world of professional golf, and TV crews are going to be packing up everywhere to cover poker tournaments because nobody's going to be interested. No, I'm exaggerating. I'm sure that there will be some fine golf played by some people who we have never paid attention to before and think of how thrilling it will be when Tiger finally returns to the tour sometime in 2009.
Well, Major League Baseball is nearing its halfway mark, and there's been a lot of buzz about the Tampa Bay Rays. They're the third best record in baseball, and they just swept 3 interleague games from the Chicago Cubs. Does this surprise you?
Well, it would have surprised me until a couple of weeks ago when I visited the Rays in the visitors' locker room clubhouse there at Fenway Park when they were in to play Boston. This is a team that's having not only playing very well, but having a lot of fun. It's a young group. They brought in a couple of veterans before the 2008 season began, and they really believe that this is not a fluke, that they are capable of playing excellent baseball right on through the fall. So I'm no longer surprised. I think this is a really good club, young pitchers. I think the oldest starting pitcher is 26. They're fantastic to watch, great fun, and more power to them.
Well, let's look ahead to Wimbledon, which gets underway Monday. Roger Federer will be looking to reconfirm his tennis supremacy after what some called a humiliating loss to Rafael Nadal in the French Open 12 days ago. Can he come back to capture what would be a modern-era record-breaking 6th trophy at Wimbledon?
Well, first of all, it's never humiliating to lose to Rafael Nadal, especially if you're playing in the French Open, because that's pretty much his personal possession as far as tennis tournaments go. And I certainly think Roger Federer can come back. You talk to people to the extent that a comeback is necessary at this stage, but you talk to people who know tennis. This is one of the more dominant players in the history of the game, and there's no question he can win again.
Well, what about the women? Justine Henin is out, retired earlier this year. Is the trophy up for grabs?
Absolutely up for grabs. And I'm not sure which of the unpronounceable names I should put at the top of the list, but I'm sure one of them will win it.
We've got a Sharapovich, an Ivanovic. Stay tuned for that next week, and we'll see who wins. Bill Littlefield is host of National Public Radio's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you, Monica.
Coming up, we remember the youngest Marine to be awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his bravery in combat. His story is just ahead, here and now. We thought we'd take some time to remember the extraordinary heroism of a World War II veteran who died this month. Jack Lucas was the youngest Marine to be awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award for bravery in combat. He was only 17 when he performed his heroic acts at the Battle of Iwo Jima, and only 14 when he forged his mother's signature on enlistment papers in order to join the Marines. Jack Lucas wrote about his experiences in the book Indestructible, the unforgettable story of a Marine hero at the Battle of Iwo Jima. And he spoke to Here and Now's Alex Ashlock on Memorial Day of 2006. As Jack Lucas told Alex, his age didn't come up during basic training.
What about the other Marines there? Did they have any idea you were so young?
No, negative. I was as big as a lot of them, and just as strong, and probably looked as mature as they. So I got by with it, and later went on out to Hawaiian Island, where we did further training. We went to Camp Catlin near Honolulu. What happened there was my first mistake. I responded to a letter back home and wrote in there about my age. Well, I forgot all about censors. The officers always read the outgoing mail back home to keep military information being transmitted.
So they found out you were only what? Were you 15 then?
15 yeah. Now.
What'd they do to you?
They took me to the colonel in Pearl Harbor, and he said, "Young man, we found out you're just 15 years old. We won't have to discharge you." I said, "Sir, if you discharge me, I'm going back and join the Army and give them benefit of my Marine Corps training." So he agreed to let me stay. He put me to driving a supply truck. Well, I did that for a long, good while before all these ships came in the harbor. That was months that went by, of course, and we were traveling fast on this radio. But you can imagine about 40,000 men on troops being given liberty that day, and I knew that they were getting their last liberty. It was like getting the last supper before a battle. Well, I got liberty, and I just rolled up an extra pair of fatigues under my arm and a long pair of shoes, went to Pearl Harbor, and they had Higgins boats that were shuttling troops back and forth from Liberty back to their ships. I just got on a Higgins boat and went to the first ship that it deposited me on, and that's where I stayed.
You didn't have any idea where that ship was going?
Well, I knew all those ships were going to go somewhere to a battle, and that's where I wanted to go. It didn't have to have a name to it.
Tell us now what happened to you on Iwo Jima. You write about in your book about seeing fellow Marines taking direct hits from mortar rounds. You describe them as being evaporated right before your eyes.
That's right. They just were there, and then they're gone. There was so much shelling. In fact, the Japanese general, his theory was to let a lot of the troops ashore before we really let loose. That way we get more kills per shell. And he was smart in doing that. It was costly to us because we lost 5,320 men dead and wounded the first 2 days.
Hmm.
Well, on the second day, we were moving up, fighting the Japanese along the first airstrip. We'd already the first day, our regiment had fought across the small neck of the island, and the second day we were fighting the Japanese along the first airfield. And we just knocked out a peel box there, and our fire team ran to this trench that the Japanese had dug. They dig a lot of trenches, about 20 foot long, parallel, two trenches at a time, parallel to one another. And at the end of the trenches were holes where they could go underground and go to the peel box, or adversely, they could escape from the peel box and go underground and come out into those trenches, and they wouldn't be direct fire, see, mm-hmm. by having to come out into a trench. Well, we took refuge in this trench thinking we would have some protection from all that exchange of fire. What we didn't know was in the other trench was 11 Japanese. Our group leader jumped over in the other trench and jumped on the back of a Japanese, and he immediately jumped back in our trench. And these Japanese stood up in front of us. Well, we opened fire almost point blank at them. I killed two in that particular instance. And the second one shot my rifle jam. But it was just fate that it would happen. By my rifle jamming, I looked down to unjam my rifle, and I saw my buddy on my right. There were two grenades at his feet. Well, he hadn't even seen the grenades, obviously, or he would have had hollered grenades and ran as fast as he could or something, some kind of action. Well, no action had been taken. I saw the grenades, and I didn't know whether they've been in there 2 seconds, 1 second, or 3 seconds. The maximum time you have is 4 to 5 seconds after you detonate a hand grenade. Well, I saw the two grenades. I rammed my rifle into one and fell over on it and pulled the other grenade, grabbed it with my right hand, pulled it underneath me, and immediately exploded and blew me over my back. I don't know how this was ever possible to have 200 holes in me, puncturing my right lung, shrapnel in both shoulders and chest, side, right thigh, right arm, right hand, and some went up into my helmet and ricocheted down into my head. And two pieces the size of 2.22 bullets went into my front lobe of my brain, blew my left eye out of my cheek, blew me over my back, and I never lost conscious.
Hmm.
If I had, I would have drowned in my own blood because of the bleeding coming out of my mouth and nose. Plus, I had a lot of blood reeking out of holes all over me. Well, I immediately I had good training from my mother, and I said, God, please save me. And believe me, Alex, I stopped bleeding.
Hmm.
And that's a profound profession to the Lord. He stopped it. Nobody else said to stop it. My men had gone on fighting, and they left me for dead. I was finally rescued by another outfit moving up, saw me, and they called a corpsman forward, and he immediately medicated me with morphine to reduce the pain, the severe pain, and started bandage areas that he could bandage. As he was kneeling there beside me, another Japanese started to come out of the hole at the end of the trench to throw another grenade on us, and he killed that chap. He saved me medically and saved me by killing the Jap. So I went home after that. I didn't hear any further about any kind of medal or anything else. In fact, I wasn't even interested in any medal. Well, I wanted to go home and get some lip sugar for my sweetie. And so that's where I headed after I got out. And a few days after that, I got a call that I was to talk to somebody from Washington, D.C. And the call from the, I think it was the president's secretary, called and told me it wanted me in Washington on October the 2nd to receive the Medal of Honor.
Tell me about what President Truman said to you when he gave you
He said, like he told all of them, that he'd rather have that medal and be president of the United States. Well, I was probably a little smarter kid. I said, well, I'll swap you, sir. I'd have hung that thing around his neck quick and taken over the reins in the United States. You imagine the good times we would have had if I'd been president.
That's Medal of Honor winner Jack Lucas speaking to Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. After fighting cancer, Lucas died on June 5th at the age of 80. To hear the full interview, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Monica Brady-Myrov. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.